Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed. This week, instead of having an addendum on episode one of our new series on Rocky Myers, we are actually going to be doing a bonus episode to give an update on two cases that we've covered in earlier seasons, seasons two and three of Undisclosed. But before moving on, Rabia here, and I just want to say hi to my colleagues, Susan and Colin. Hey, guys.
Hey, Rabia.
Hey, Rabia.
Okay, so there's been some important developments. Now, unfortunately, even though our work is great and important, we believe in it, it does move like molasses, and our listeners always want to know what's going on. And there have been developments in both the Joey Watkins and Dennis Perry cases. And so we thought we'd do a whole episode to kind of go over what's happening. And then we'll also revisit some of the other cases that we've been doing later this summer. So let's start with Joey.
We've been waiting for this ruling for a year now. So it's been some time. But after our season two series, the Georgia Innocence Project filed a habeas petition for Joey, up in Walker County, where he's then being held in prison. And there was a hearing on the state's motion to dismiss. The state argued that because Joey Watkins had waited too many years to bring this petition, and because he'd also brought a previous habeas petition based on the cell phone evidence in his case, that he had no right to bring claims before the court ever again, essentially. So even though he had claims based on Brady violations, the state's withholding of exculpatory evidence, and based on newly discovered juror misconduct, based on a juror who independently attempted to conduct a drive test in the cell phone evidence, based definitively on an incorrect assumption about places and distances traveled, the trial court ruled in favor of the state, found that it was Joey Watkins' obligation to discover new evidence, to find the jurors had done misconduct, and that if he didn't find it within the habeas time period, well, those claims are gone forever. Now, this was contrary to existing case law. There was cases directly on point on many of these issues for both the Brady issues and for the juror misconduct issue. And we felt pretty optimistic about the Supreme Court reversing the trial court's decision. I mean, the precedent was clear. The trial court did not follow it. And I don't like to ever get hopeful, but I really thought that there was no way the court could rule against Joey on this. Turns out the court did not need a rule against Joey on this. When it comes to the Supreme Court in Georgia, in a criminal case, if a defendant wins and the state appeals, that is automatically heard by the Supreme Court. Like, every time, automatically, they have the right to make the court issue a ruling. If a defendant loses in the trial court, they have a discretionary ability to appeal, which means the Supreme Court doesn't want to hear it. They don't gotta. And here, Supreme Court did not want to hear it. What that means is that, in effect, the trial court's ruling about Joey's claims having expired stands. I mean, this ruling is terrible for... It's not even a ruling. It was a refusal to hear the appeal. And it has terrible implications for not just defendants, actually, for a lot of people in the state of Georgia. What it means for every other defendant in the state of Georgia is that as soon as their case is finalized, as soon as there's a verdict returned or there's an appeal that's completed, they are on the clock to discover all misconduct and discover all Brady violations before time runs out. Now, what that means is that you essentially have a situation where people who are in prison and cannot do this stuff themselves often do not have attorneys and have no right to an attorney unless they can pay for one, have an obligation to seek out and interview every single juror in their case, which is not something jurors want to have happen. It's already hard enough in Georgia and elsewhere to get people to serve on the jury and to put a jury together. If jurors know that by doing so, and if they convict the defendant, that defendant will have an obligation to have his friends and family, if he doesn't have an attorney, seek them out and interview them about why they reached their decision, it's going to be even harder to get a jury. Same with the Brady violations. Because the court refused to hear the Brady violations at all, this is not a ruling that the Brady violations weren't a due process violation or that they didn't occur, just that the court doesn't have to hear it or can't hear them anymore. What this means is that in Georgia, prosecutors now know if you hide evidence and keep it hidden, all you got to do is keep it hidden for long enough and you're home clear.
Yeah. This is bad law.
It's not a law. I mean, that's the frustrating part too, is that by doing this, the Supreme Court of Georgia is effectively making like a two-track legal system. You have what the law says, what the precedent says, what the books say, and then you have the laws apply to Joey Watkins, which is whatever the trial court said, regardless of the fact it's contrary to the law for everyone else.
This is the law that as it applies to Joey Watkins, but then the state can then apply it to other folks. I mean, like, that's how they're going to, it's going to be used. That's why you're saying it's dangerous for other people, right?
Other trial courts. Well, yes, by not taking action here, it's a signal that the Supreme Court does not feel a need to write this issue. And it's a signal other trial courts can issue similar rulings and other prosecutors can file similar motions to dismiss and expect the Supreme Court will not intervene or grant relief, which is why defendants in Georgia must be on notice now that, yeah, whether you have an attorney or not, once your conviction is final, you got to get out there and start tracking down every juror and make them tell you what happened in that jury room.
What are the options for Joey?
Well, his attorneys, they had 10 days. This was last week, or 2 weeks ago now it came out, that they had 10 days to file a motion for consideration, which they did. That is currently pending and will likely be ruled upon in short order. But as motions for reconsideration usually go, it's not one to get your hopes up about.
Colin?
Yeah, so I have two observations. The first is I fully expect the next couple of years, the Georgia legislature or someone handling their rules is going to create a rule that says that the losing party in a case is not allowed to contact jurors without permission, because you're going to start hearing about jurors being harassed in Georgia, and this is going to lead to the unintended consequence, which is intended, or at least expected, in the sense that, yeah, this is going to lead to losing parties harassing jurors and trying to get them to change their mind. And then the second is there's the obvious parallel here between now Joy Watkins and Adnan Syed, in that in Adnan Syed case, trial court finds he has a winning issue. His attorney failed to use the AT&T disclaimer. Substantively, he gets a new trial. Only reason he's not free today is because the higher courts found that he waived this issue. Same thing with Joy Watkins. I think the Brady claim could have won. I think the juror doing the drive test is 100% a winning issue and substantively is grounds for a new trial. And as in Adnan Syed's case, pretty much the only reason that Joy Watkins is still in prison is because procedurally the court found this is defaulted. And just as I expect this to affect, as Susan noted, many other defendants in Georgia, I did a blog post about this. There's a case, Hyman versus State, out of the Court of Appeals of Maryland in 2019, already using the precedent of Adnan's case to say there's waiver of a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel if that is on different grounds than an initial claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. The same thing as in Adnan's case, alibi to cell tower, and denying relief to a defendant. And again, not in the merits, but based upon that issue being waived. And so it's pretty disheartening to have these two cases with absolutely winning issues substantively, and yet procedurally these courts are sort of bending backwards to deny the defendants the chance to even present these issues to a court.
Yeah, the juror issue was as close as it gets to a slam dunk, legally speaking, because, I mean, the case law is directly on point. What happened here was a constitutional violation. Joey was deprived of his right to have evidence presented in court. Because what the juror did is she listened to arguments made by Tammy Colson, the prosecutor, which incorrectly stated various facts about the cell phone towers and the routes traveled. And based on these incorrect, inaccurate, no, just plain false representations, which is all this juror would have heard because no maps were provided to them, she went and tried to drive the route herself. And she concluded that it was like maybe kind of sort of possible, kind of. And she changed her vote because of that. She thought that the juror, the way she explained it to me was so heartbreaking, is that it wasn't even that she found beyond reasonable doubt. It's just she no longer had like compelling evidence of innocence. So she switched her vote, and as did another juror she spoke to about her drive test. Now, the worst part of all of this, and there's a lot of worse parts, is that that cell phone evidence is conclusive proof of Joey Watkins' innocence. It's not even a question. If the juror had known the right places to drive, if she'd known the right times, she could never have ever reached a decision she did that it might have been possible for Joey to have done this. And that's why this is such a clear constitutional violation. There was evidence that was never presented in court that the jury heard and jury based their verdict on and shouldn't have because it wasn't accurate, hadn't been tested by the trial. And now Joey's left with no way to bring in state court these Brady claims and the juror claim. And the part I always come back to is that his case is one where it is so black and white. I believe firmly his innocence is shown by all the other evidence in the case we covered. But for the cell phone issue, if I could just sit with someone and just show them the pure numbers, there's only one conclusion you could reach. It's not some sort of ambiguous case. It is flat out. Just let me walk you through it. And once you see the numbers, what they mean, there is no way to conclude that Joey Watkins could have done this. It is that clear cut. And he has lost any right to ever argue that in a state of Georgia.
I know Undisclosed listeners have some pretty sharp minds and they like to keep them finely tuned. So let me share with you one really fun way to do that, and that is Best Fiends. It is a 5-star rated mobile puzzle game. It is so much fun. It has these cute characters. It is actually fiendishly fun. I know that's a pun on the name, but look, it is what it is. So this is how the game works. They are cute little characters. Most of them are bugs, okay? And the antagonists are slugs, but they are adorable. There's an epic storyline that keeps you engaged with the game for hours. I mean, like literally, you can go through thousands of hours of gameplay, and there's thousands of fun puzzles to solve. And that's the thing. That does keep your brain sharp, but it also is a lot of fun. It's a great casual game to play alone or with family and friends. And here's the thing. Anybody can actually play this game. Adults can play it. My 10-year-old loves it. Best Fiends has over 90 million downloads globally. 90 million. And it's 5-star rated on the Apple App Store and Google Play. You can also, by the way, play offline anywhere. You know, if you want to squeeze in another level on the go or play on the plane or in the subway where you don't get signal. So don't miss out and join millions of others playing this incredibly fiendishly fun game. Once again, Best Fiends. You can download it totally free at the Apple App Store or on Google Play. Now, once again, it's Best Fiends. That's like friends, but without the R. Best Fiends. So a couple of questions. First, you said there's a motion to reconsider that's been filed. We'll expect a ruling sometime soon. Once there's a ruling on that, let's say it's denied, which is what is most likely, does that mean the door to the U.S. Supreme Court is closed for Joey as well because they just declined to even hear it?
I don't actually know that procedurally what the situation would be there. I know that this is definitely not the end of his filings. His attorneys are currently figuring out what their next strategy is going to be. Federal court is probably where they're going to have to go because state court is likely, they've exhausted their options there.
Okay. And in federal court, do you know if the basis would be like an actual innocence claim or would it be, again, on one of the procedural, like the Brady ground or something else? I mean,
as far as attorneys to consider, I don't think they've, as far as I know, they haven't reached a decision there yet about what their best procedural strategy is. But because of the way his case has played out in state court, in which he is being procedurally blocked from ever bringing forward these claims, he is left at a disadvantage. The evidence isn't even in the record for the courts to consider at this stage. It's just a blank denial based on the fact that, I mean, what the trial court found is that even though the state hid evidence that was exculpatory using a secret case number that was never disclosed to the defense and was only found by pure luck and like 5 or 6 series of open records requests to the GBI, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. The fact that in the end it was only found because some medical examiner now in Florida happened to have a big old stack of paper in his closet that he never got rid of from Georgia that had that case number recorded. That's how the evidence was found in this case. The evidence that the prosecutor told the jury and the court didn't exist when in fact the records show it was in her possession at that moment.
I'm sure our listeners also want to know how Joey himself is doing. Are you still in touch with him?
I mean, he's okay. Is that probably the best I can say? He knows how this goes. He's been doing this for 20 years, and he knows that it takes a miracle to get anything done and that your innocence and that your evidence and that your claims often don't mean anything if the court doesn't want to hear it. To some extent, I think it's fair to say that he has so little hope in the system that he had less room to be disappointed by it in the first place. But yeah, it's a blow. And we will still be here disclosed, like covering his case and pursuing it. But this does mean more years of his life are lost in prison now.
Uh, Okay, so we're going to move on now, and we're going to talk about updates in Dennis Perry's case.
Yeah, Dennis Perry, we covered his case last year in season 3 of Undisclosed. It was also with the Georgia Innocence Project. Now, for habeas petitions, which is what was recently filed, if you find new evidence in a defense case after the conviction, that starts a one-year clock, which is a time period which you can bring some sort of action, typically a habeas action, and have those claims preserved. After that one-year period, you might have some routes through state court, but your federal routes to relief are basically over with. So in Dennis Perry's case, we first started airing episodes, I think in July of 2018, and we found a series of important new pieces of evidence. Now, out of an abundance of caution and out of fear of how courts are so willing to deny any kind of relief on purely procedural grounds to find a way to not rule on the merits of a claim, based on certain interviews we had in June of 2018, that was the one-year deadline effectively could have started then. I would definitely argue it was much later when certain pieces of evidence were found. But if a court was trying its hardest to exclude Dennis Perry's right to ever be heard, that's when they would start the clock ticking. So that one-year deadline coming up pretty quick, obviously. And last week, Dennis Perry, through his attorneys at Georgia Innocence Project, and also through his attorneys at King & Spalding, who are representing him pro bono, filed a habeas petition on his behalf. I spoke to Jennifer Whitfield, who is Dennis's attorney at GIP, and you may have heard in the last few episodes of Dennis's series after she joined GIP in fall of 2018. And she told me about what happened with this petition and what to expect going forward in the future.
So last week, we filed a petition for habeas relief on behalf of Dennis. And by we, I mean Georgia Innocence Project and King & Spalding. And in that petition, we allege a number of different claims, including the claim that he should be released because he is actually innocent. And so that is by far the biggest news right now in his case. And that came about as a result of King & Spalding's exhaustive work with his records. They did what you did last year and what we did last year, which is review the entire enormous file. And then collectively we came, you know, pulled together the best claims that we could come up with on behalf of Dennis to explain to the court what happened here.
I also spoke to Joshua Toll, who's the pro bono partner at King & Spalding. And he gave me a statement on behalf of all the attorneys at King & Spalding who've been working on Dennis's case. King & Spalding is proud to partner with the Georgia Innocence Project in representing Dennis Perry on a pro bono basis. Habeas corpus matters, like this one, are an important part of our pro bono program, as we see these matters as vindicating basic principles of fairness in our criminal justice system, and ensuring that every person accused of a crime receives the constitutional protections to which he or she is entitled. Here, through our investigation and the investigation of others, we believe there is compelling new evidence that demonstrates that Mr. Perry did not receive a fair trial and is not guilty of the charged offenses, which we have detailed in his habeas petition. We look forward to the opportunity to present all the new evidence to the court in an effort to show that Mr. Perry is entitled to a new trial and the other relief he seeks.
Now, if you listened to season 3 and heard us describe in episode 1 how Dennis gave up his rights to ever appeal his conviction, you may be wondering, wait, Dennis filed for habeas relief in court? Wasn't that something that was never an option for Dennis in the first place?
This all goes back to Dennis's sentencing agreement, the one he entered into on the night that he was convicted. The prosecutor in his case had sought the death penalty. So when the jury came back with a guilty verdict, the next step would normally have been to move into the sentencing phase. There'd be a hearing, and the jury would then go back to deliberate to determine whether or not Dennis Perry was to be executed. Instead, Prosecutor John Johnson spoke to Dennis's defense attorneys and offered them a deal. If Dennis Perry agreed to never appeal his conviction, the state would agree to impose a life sentence instead, and not to seek to have him executed. So, on the advice of counsel, and after being told that he had no further time to consider the issue, Dennis took the deal. In a plea colloquy before Judge Amanda Williams, Perry stated that he agreed to, quote, give up his right to appeal. So, through that sentencing agreement, Dennis Perry did give up his right to appeal his conviction. But Dennis is not appealing his conviction. That's not what's happening here. He filed a habeas petition.
When someone is convicted and incarcerated, there are a few types of post-conviction proceedings they can pursue. One of them is a criminal appeal, where the defendant challenges their conviction based upon errors in the trial process that result in their conviction. But there's also a civil proceeding they can pursue, a habeas corpus petition. A defendant can file a habeas petition to challenge his incarceration based upon things that happened outside of the trial itself and outside of the courtroom. When Dennis Perry came before Judge Amanda Williams and entered his sentencing agreement, he agreed to waive his right to appeal his conviction. But no one, not the prosecutor, not the defense, not the judge, and certainly not Dennis Perry himself, ever suggested that he also gave up his post-conviction rights outside of the criminal system. So why then did no one try to file for post-conviction relief in Dennis's case before now? Well, in part because the prosecutor in this case did a good job of confusing the record to make it all seem on paper that Dennis Perry had agreed to something he'd never agreed to at all.
And, you know, Dennis had his hands particularly tied here, and the misunderstanding is I think, in part due to the fact that John Johnson and Judge Williams entered into the court record a pleading describing the sentencing agreement and describing Dennis's waiver of his rights. But the description that they give in that pleading that he never signed and his defense counsel never signed is not the same as what he actually waived at the sentencing agreement when you look at the transcript.
It's clear. It's there, like, again and again and again, they say it's appeal. He's waiving his appeal rights.
It does not mean he's waiving his right to all post-conviction relief ever. And that is what the sentencing agreement that's filed by only John Johnson and Judge Williams.
The sentencing agreement that was filed with the court and there in the court's record today was actually never reviewed by Dennis Perry or his defense. Instead, it was prepared by the prosecutor and signed only by the prosecutor and the judge before being entered into the record. But a prosecutor can't waive a defendant's rights for them. And Dennis Perry never agreed to waive his habeas rights. And that's what he's filed now through his attorneys with GIP and King and Spalding. And that filing is pretty comprehensive in what it covers.
Yeah, it is 130 pages. It's a very exhaustive petition.
It's very long. But, you know, as you also know, and as your listeners know, there are a zillion things, a zillion injustices that happened to Dennis throughout his trial and throughout the investigation. And this doesn't capture all of those.
Yeah. I mean, every case, you have to choose which ones to focus on, which not to. And it's always a hard call. But I think there's some really strong issues that y'all focused on for his petition.
In Dennis Perry's habeas petition, his lawyers laid out four grounds for relief. His first claim alleges violations of his due process rights as a result of the state's withholding of exculpatory, impeachment, and other favorable evidence for the defense. That is a Brady claim.
The first claim alleges prosecutorial misconduct because the state failed to reveal critical information to Dennis's trial. And there's three separate pieces of that claim that are spelled out in the petition. One involves Jane Beaver and the fact that she was trying to collect a substantial reward. And the next involves Donnie Barentine's interrogation by and confession to Dixie Foster, who you, Susan, learned was actually Glenn Foster last year during your investigation. And then the third involves the composite picture and the reliability of that composite that was used to convict Dennis, because as you know, the state held up the composite as evidence that Dennis was the guy because he looked like the composite. But one of the things that we found in his files was a internal memo saying one of the eyewitnesses, Gwen Owens, didn't think the composite looked like the shooter. And that was not disclosed to the defense team, and that would have made a big difference.
So if you listen to our season 3 case on Dennis Perry, you know that there was a massive amount of potentially exculpatory information that the state was aware about and never disclosed to defense, much more than just the three issues that are laid out in Dennis Perry's petition. And that's one of the stressful parts of post-conviction work. When you bring your client's claim before the court, you have to choose very carefully how you're going to frame the case and what issues you're going to bring forward. It is a very hard choice to make. And there's no way for any attorney to ever make the perfect decision about what to claim and what not to claim, because you can't make that decision without knowing what the future holds. both the factual future in terms of what evidence could be uncovered later on and the procedural future in terms of what direction the case takes as it winds its way through the court system. So claims that may have seemed less critical or less likely to persuade a court could turn out to have had some procedural advantage that you couldn't have known about at the time, or a claim that may have seemed weak may, with the discovery of new evidence, become ironclad. But because you didn't include that claim in your filing, your client could be held responsible for waiving their rights to that claim altogether.
But because attorneys don't have crystal balls, they weigh the options and make the best call they can with the information they have. And the attorneys at the Georgia Innocence Project and King & Spalding chose to focus on three Brady violations with the clearest legal heft. The first of these was the confession of Donnie Barentine, the case's alternate suspect. Now, before trial, the defense was aware of Donnie Barentine's existence, and they knew he'd been a suspect in the case for many years. In fact, Dennis Perry's entire defense strategy can be summed up as, Donnie Barentine did it. The defense even called Barentine himself to the stand to testify at trial, and they also called numerous witnesses who'd known Barentine back in the 1980s, and they said they'd heard him make statements in which he claimed responsibility for the murder of a black couple at a church in Georgia. The defense knew all that and tried to build their case out of it. But what the defense didn't know is that back in 1985, just a few months after the murders, investigators had brought an interrogation specialist named Glenn Foster in from Atlanta to have him interview Donnie Barentine. And in that interview, Barentine made a confession. The state knew about this confession, but the only reason we know of it now is because of a stray comment by a GBI agent who was brought onto the Dennis Perry case not long before trial. That GBI agent, Agent Troll, was not involved in the beginning stages of the case, but was present at the time that Donnie Barentine was brought into Camden County for a taped deposition. And in that taped deposition, Agent Troll asked Donnie Barentine a question.
Many years ago, when you were in jail with all this mess, everything, the McRae and all that, you were interviewed by a man named Beefy Foster. Do you remember that? When you talked to Mr. Foster years ago, apparently at some point during the interview, according to what I've read in the previous case file, you said, I did. And then immediately you went back and said, I'm this kid. Do you remember that?
No. Dennis's defense attorneys did have this videotape back before his trial, and they heard that comment too. And they had exactly the kinds of questions about it that you'd expect. Like, who was Dixie Foster? And what exactly was this, I did it, but haha, just kidding confession that Barentine had apparently made to this Dixie Foster? It sounds like that maybe could have been important, right? Now, the part about Barentine saying he'd killed the Swains and then saying he was just kidding, that might have sounded a little familiar to the defense, because that is something Barentine had claimed about with a different confession that he'd made while drunk at a house party in Florida and was talking to some of his friends and claimed to have killed a black couple in a church in Georgia. As for that supposed confession, Barentine did once claim apparently that he was merely kidding about it and hadn't really done it. He was just talking. So in context, it could seem that perhaps that's all Agent Troll is referencing, that maybe this talk of a confession wasn't something totally new or something totally a huge deal at all. But the name Dixie Foster was totally new to Dennis Perry's attorneys. That name had never been mentioned to them before by anyone, and they wanted to know more. So defense attorney Dale Wessling wrote to prosecutor John Johnson and asked him about it. Who's Dixie Foster and what's his confession? But John Johnson just ignored their question. He never responded to them, and they never got an answer.
Especially with Glenn Foster and the confession. I mean, that one is frustrating on so many levels, because what more could the defense have done? They did recognize there was an issue. They picked up on the small clue there was that something was really wrong here, and they tried to pursue it. And they wrote a letter to the prosecutor asking for more information and got nothing back. I mean, that's a point blank. I mean, it's in cases where that happens, that does weigh in the defense's favor, where there's actually been a request for a Brady material and they've been told or they've gotten a response about it, that it didn't exist.
Right. And we now know that instead of writing Dennis or his defense team back explaining what happened and who Dixie Foster in fact is and, you know, his identity, instead they wrote a email to Donnie Barentine.
Yeah.
And explaining to him, you know, that the defense was trying to reach out to him and coaching him on, you know, what to say and how to answer questions.
Yeah. Well, Prosecutor John Johnson didn't write back to the defense, but he did write an email to Barentine himself. And the prosecutor suggested that if the defense did find Barentine and tried to ask him any questions about past statements he'd made, he should stick with his "I don't remember" story.
Home-cooked meals made simple. HelloFresh makes conquering the kitchen a reality with deliciously simple recipes. HelloFresh does all the meal planning, shopping, and prepping so you can focus on a healthier you and a happier family. You can get seasonal simple recipes and pre-measured ingredients delivered right to your door every single week. With HelloFresh, all meals come together in 30 minutes max, call for less than 2 pots and pans, and require minimal cleanup. There are 3 plans to choose from: Classic, Veggie, and Family, with the option to switch among the 3 from when your tastes change. Now, I recently had the chance to try HelloFresh, and it's quickly become my favorite meal kit delivery service, both in terms of ease of preparation and selection and quality of the food. This week, I'm scheduled to get the blackened tilapia tacos and the lobster ravioli and shrimp, and I can't wait to taste both. And now you too can try HelloFresh. For $80 off your first month of HelloFresh, go to HelloFresh.com/undisclosed80 and enter undisclosed80. It's like receiving 8 meals for free. Again, for $80 off your first month of HelloFresh, go to HelloFresh.com/undisclosed80 and enter undisclosed80.
What the defense didn't know at the time of Dennis's trial is that Dixie Foster was the legal name of Glenn Foster, that former law enforcement official that Barentine confessed to. And Glenn Foster doesn't go by Dixie Foster. So, you know, if they were looking for him under that name, they just weren't ever going to find him. But if they had found Foster, well, then Foster would have told them what he told the court in his affidavit that was submitted with Dennis's petition. That when Barentine made these confessions to him, there was no sort of just kidding about it. Barentine was deadly serious when he made those statements. And if Dennis's lawyer, Dale Westling, had known any of this, things would have been really different at his trial.
Now, did you speak to Westling, Dennis's defense attorney, for this?
We did. There's an affidavit from Westling as part of the filing.
And what did that discuss?
So the affidavit primarily covers what Westling knew at the time of trial and what he didn't know. And of course, for the Brady claims that we brought, it covers the fact that Westling didn't know that information at the time of trial. And if he did, it would have made a big difference to him. It would have been meaningful to him, and it would have changed the way he handled the case.
Now, the second Brady claim in Dennis's petition has to do with Jane Beaver and the reward money she was paid after his conviction. Jane Beaver was an important witness for the state. She was, in fact, their star witness. She was the sole witness called by the state to provide evidence that Dennis Perry had a motive to kill the Swains, through her testimony about Dennis telling her either a few days or a few weeks before the murders about how he'd, quote, always wondered what it would be like to kill a N-word, and now I'm going to get me one. Jane Beaver was also the sole witness that provided evidence Dennis had the opportunity to kill the Swains through her surprise testimony on the witness stand about the fire breaks. Beaver claimed she'd only remembered this evidence at court on that day, so she never had mentioned it to the prosecutor before, which is why the prosecutor never had a chance to tell the defense about it. According to Jane Beaver, Dennis Perry liked to walk fire breaks and he wasn't scared of snakes.
The implication of the surprise fire break testimony from Jane Beaver was that Dennis Perry, who did not have a car, could have gotten to Rising Daughter that night by instead walking the fire breaks, or a hypothetical fire break that may or may not have existed between his house and Rising Daughter Baptist Church. And because he was not afraid of the snakes, he was able to make this journey, even though most people would not have gone back there. I talked to a number of the jurors from Dennis Perry's trial, and the stuff about Dennis Perry wanting to kill a black person or about him walking fire breaks, that was evidence they told me about that convinced them of Dennis's guilt. But what the jurors didn't know was that Jane Beaver was not the unbiased witness that she appeared on the stand. Jane Beaver had been promised a reward if Dennis Perry was convicted, and after he went to prison, she was paid the money that she'd been promised, or at least half the money anyway. And we have the documents now to prove it.
The reward payment came from Camden County's civil asset forfeiture funds, the money that Camden County seized along Highway 95 and kept for itself. And thanks to Sheriff Bill Smith's frequent misuse of those funds, in 2007, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation was involved in auditing the bank accounts that were used to disperse those funds. Recently, GIP was able to obtain an official copy of those records from the GBI, and they confirmed what we reported in our series last year, that shortly after Dennis's trial, in March of 2003, Jane Beaver was given a check for $12,000 out of the Camden County Seized Assets Fund. And in the description line, someone had written down the money was being paid for a, quote, reward. Those audit documents from the GBI showed that another witness had been paid $12,000 as well, and that was Brian Corky Rozier, who never actually testified at Dennis Perry's trial. We'll get more into that in a bit. But to make things worse for Dennis, Jane Beaver didn't just receive this $12,000 out of the blue, as an unexpected boon from the state after her testimony was over and done with. She'd known about this money. She had wanted that money very badly, and she made her desire for that money crystal clear to John Johnson. We know this because last year Susan went down to Camden County with attorneys from the Georgia Innocence Project, and while they were there, they discovered in the DA's file a series of phone memos that had been taken down by the DA's office in the lead-up to Dennis's trial. Now, many of them were messages left by Jane Beaver for Prosecutor John Johnson, including one message that Jane Beaver left for the DA on January 14, 2000, the day after Dennis Perry's arrest. It said,
Jane Beaver has a question about the reward money. Says it was because of the picture and info she turned in on that case, solved. Says they have told her that the reward money is no longer there. Please call her. She wants to collect reward.
By the time I began investigating this case last year, Jane Beaver was in the hospital and suffering from dementia. She was never available to be interviewed, and she passed away while season 3 was still airing, in September of last year. But I was able to speak with her daughter, Carol Ann. That's Dennis Perry's ex-girlfriend, who he dated back in 84 and 85. And when I asked Carol Ann about the reward money in the case, she'd known exactly what I was talking about. Oh yeah, she told me. Her mother had seen the reward offered in that crime program. And Carol Ann said, her mother had in fact gotten that reward money. Or rather, she'd gotten half of the money. Jane Beaver had been pretty ticked off about that, Carol Ann told me, because Jane Beaver thought that she'd been the only witness who came forward with anything useful, and she thought that she should have gotten all the reward. But the prosecutor was not the only one who knew about Jane Beaver's interest in the reward money. In December of 2018, not long before the final episode of season 3 aired, I had a phone call with Deputy Dale Bundy. Well, actually, I had two phone calls. The first phone call was a somewhat tense conversation, at least on his end. Bundy had some interesting ideas he wanted to share with me about what I could do with my investigation, and then he hung up with me. A little while later, he called back to apologize and offered to try again to answer questions. During that conversation, he told me that he had nothing to do with the decision to pay the reward money to Jane Beaver, that that had been a call made by someone above him, hadn't involved him, wasn't him, basically. He told me that his only involvement with the reward had been when, sometime before trial, he'd gone over to Jane Beaver's house to interview her. Bundy told me that during this interview, Beaver had asked him about whether there was a reward in the case. And Bundy said he'd told her, yeah, there was a reward, but only for a successful prosecution.
And he told her before trial. That's key. She got on the witness stand believing that if Dennis is convicted, I'm going to get a $25,000 payday. And courts recognize that incentivized witnesses, courts recognize that telling a jury that a witness is seeking a payment for her testimony is meaningful to a jury, that they care about that. I mean, courts recognize that repeatedly. And so, yeah, this is kind of the classic example of information that is required to be disclosed because it's so important. And Jane Beaver was such an important witness. We talk about that in some length.
Yeah, and it's not like a theoretical concern. Like, juries get it. Juries intuitively understand that when you offer money to someone, it can change their testimony. And testimony that seems otherwise, like unbiased, like, why would they do that? And you find out money's involved, you're like, oh, that's why they might lie.
Right, right. Which is, you know, when you think about it, when you take a step back, it's so, so upsetting because that piece of information could have change things for Dennis. It could have changed the trajectory of his life. And he didn't have the opportunity to ask those questions. You know, he didn't have the opportunity to tell a jury.
Now, if the defense attorney had known about the reward, it would have been effective impeachment, and he would have been able to use it. And as a result, Jane Beaver might not have testified at all. We know this because of that other witness that got a reward, Brian Corky Rozier. He was called by the state to testify about what he'd seen as the neighbor of Dennis Perry's grandparents back at the time the Swains were killed. However, during trial, the prosecutor learned, the defense had learned, about some perjury issues that Corky Rozier had in his past. As a result, the prosecution declined to put him on the stand, knowing that if they tried, he'd be discredited and impeached. However, because the defense never knew about the reward money, they never had an opportunity to do the same with Jane Beaver.
I have been a small business owner for many, many years, from law firms to law enforcement training company. And now, of course, I co-own this podcast and another one. And let me tell you, every single time I have started a new business, every time I've needed to promote an existing business, I have turned to the same company over and over. I have been a loyal Vistaprint customer for at least a decade. I love Vistaprint products. And I'll tell you this, like, you know, when you start your first small business, especially, you don't have a lot of money to sink into, you know, items like for marketing, for business cards, for signs. These things can add up. And especially at the beginning, you just don't have any revenue coming in. And that's why I loved Vistaprint. They made it so affordable. For like 10 bucks, I got like hundreds of business cards. I mean, it was an incredible way for me to start my business, my very first law firm. Vistaprint products are not only affordable, they're wonderful quality. They're beautiful quality. So even when you start making money, believe me, you're going to want to stick with Vistaprint products. I know I have. Another thing I love about using Vistaprint is, look, I'm not a designer. I don't know how to make things look pretty, but you don't have to with Vistaprint. I mean, you can upload your own design if you have one, or you can use one of their huge range of professionally designed options and templates. They've got so many to choose from. You can pick your paper stock, style, quantity. You can even get business cards in as little as 3 days if you're in a real rush, and believe me, that's happened to me before. And finally, Vistaprint guarantees your satisfaction 100%, or they will make it right, either by reprinting your order or offering a refund. Now, I'm happy to report I've never actually needed that. I have always been completely satisfied with my Vistaprint products. In fact, I have loved them. Now look, Vistaprint wants you to be able to own the now in any situation, which is why our listeners will get 500 high-quality custom business cards starting at $9.99. Just go to Vistaprint.com/undisclosed. Once again, that's Vistaprint.com/undisclosed. Vistaprint.com/undisclosed and get 500 high quality custom business cards for less than $10. The third and final Brady claim in Dennis's habeas petition has to do with the eyewitness, Gwen Owens. She was one of the 10 women in the church that night when Harold and Thelma Swain were killed, and she was one of the four women who gotten a good look at the shooter. She had prepared an individual composite and then participated in the group composite that was later created using input from her and the three other women. Four of the church eyewitnesses testified at Dennis Perry's trial. Two of those witnesses both said they never really even got a look at the shooter, and they couldn't describe what he looked like. But Gwen Owens, who had seen the shooter and did remember what he looked like, wasn't called to testify. She had been subpoenaed by the state, and so she was at the courthouse during the trial, but she was sequestered and she wasn't able to watch the trial herself. And then she wasn't called to the stand, either by the state or the defense. Now, it's obvious why the state didn't call Gwen Owens to testify, because they knew something that the defense didn't. They knew that Gwen Owens did not believe that the composite drawing that the four women made actually look like the shooter at all. We know this because while Susan and the GIP were down in Camden County last year, they found a memorandum written by someone in the DA's office about Dennis's case. It read,
"I just spoke to Dale Bundy about having Gwendolyn and Leslie Owens interviewed. Dale advised that he did interview Gwendolyn last year, and she won't cooperate. She said that the composite picture doesn't look like the man she saw that night. Then she says she didn't get a good look at the man. GBI agent Ron Rhodes attempted to interview Leslie Owens, the girl, and she won't talk. It would help if they documented this stuff."
So the composite image was presented by the state as some of the most compelling evidence of Dennis's guilt because of its resemblance to a photograph of Dennis Perry that had been taken in 1984. But when investigator Dale Bundy had spoken to eyewitness Gwen Owens in the lead up to Dennis Perry's trial, she actually told him she didn't believe the composite looked like the shooter. And while Dale Bundy declined to make any written record memorializing what Gwen Owens had said, he did tell the prosecutor about it. But the prosecutor, in turn, never told the defense.
I mean, oh God, in terms of like things that could have changed Dennis's life, when I spoke to Gwen Owens, all I could think was like, if only she'd been called to the stand, if only she'd gotten up there. She would have been an amazing witness.
Yeah, she would have been. And one of the most powerful things she could have talked about is the amount to which she saw the shooter. She got a very good look at him. And the fact that she did not think the shooter looked like the composite drawing.
In addition to Gwen Owens, there's another eyewitness from the church who never got a chance to testify, and who also could have made a difference at Dennis's trial. That's Ms. Lavinia, the 10th eyewitness, the one the defense never even knew about. She'd been in church when the Swains were killed, but she'd left the churchyard with her family before the police even arrived in the scene.
Sadly, a few weeks back, Ms. Lavinia passed away. I'm grateful I had a chance to meet with her last year and to hear what she recalled about that night at Rising Daughter. And Dennis Perry's attorneys were hoping to speak with her as well and to obtain an affidavit from her about what she remembered from the shooting. But unfortunately, her health had taken a turn for the worse by the time they were in Camden County, and they were never able to have an opportunity to speak with her themselves or to obtain an affidavit. So Ms. Lavinia is not part of Dennis Perry's habeas petition. But there are many witnesses who submitted affidavits to the defense about what they would testify to if Dennis Perry has a chance to bring these claims to court. And there are a lot of witnesses involved. This is a complicated case with a vast world of facts that are important to the constitutional claims that Dennis is asserting.
Yeah, I suspect that, as is clear from the large number of affidavits attached to this petition, that there will be a large number of witnesses to talk about facts within the knowledge of that particular witness that, when you piece it together with everything else, paints this really clear picture that something terrible has happened here. Not just the murders, which of course were horrific, but something terrible has happened to Dennis as well.
Yeah, I think that's why I was so impressed with the brief when I read it. It just made that so succinct, like the sense of like, I mean, of course I know the facts in the case, but like reading it, just sort of this horror all over again. Like, oh my God, what did they do to him?
Yeah.
And that's
Kane
really...
and Spaulding did a really beautiful job of pulling that together. And, you know, they worked really hard on distilling kind of the information in a way that tells a story. And they, I think it came together really, really nicely.
A lot of what is in Dennis's petition is based on information discovered in the course of making this podcast, which means one of those affidavits attached to Dennis's habeas petition is from me and describes some of the information that I learned during my investigation. And critically for Dennis's habeas petition, I also provided the dates on which I learned that information, because those dates may set the clock on Dennis's claims, kicking off the one-year deadline in which Dennis Perry has to file his habeas or potentially lose a chance at federal review.
And I will say, Susan, the interviews that you did with Gwen Owens, but also just the investigatory work you did to find Dixie Foster, and the interviews you did with Carol Ann and other critical witnesses really were the roadmap for the work that we did in putting together this petition. And we're just incredibly grateful, and Dennis is incredibly grateful for all the investigatory work, because...
And now I got to show up and testify, which no attorney ever wants to do.
Yeah, I'm sorry. But that's why you don't go, you know, interviewing witnesses unless you want to become a witness yourself.
I knew the rule. I broke it.
Yes, yeah. You did. You did.
The process of testifying is never fun, but I hope very much it's something I have to do. And I hope the court gets to hear from many other witnesses as well in this case. Because the evidence of the state's violations of due process and Brady is comprehensive and compelling, and Dennis deserves a chance to bring it in open court.
Now, the second ground for relief in Dennis's habeas petition is ineffective assistance of counsel. As Jennifer Whitfield explains, the claim set forth in Dennis's petition is a bit different from the way the ineffective assistance claims are traditionally presented.
And so in addition to the Brady violations, there were some other claims, too.
There are some other claims. There is the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. That claim actually is two separate claims framed out in two different ways. But the first way it's framed out is ineffective assistance of counsel because Dennis's counsel didn't have a chance, because they weren't told critical information that they needed to make the decisions that counsel needs to make. particularly in a case like this, in a case of this size. And then the other ineffective assistance of counsel claim is a more traditional ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
Yeah, so a claim for ineffective assistance, or IAC, is based on the fact that a defendant did not have a constitutionally appropriate defense, usually because of a defense attorney's failure to investigate, to present the case, to object, to do basic actions that any reasonable defense attorney must do. But in cases like this, and a lot of the ones we've covered, where there's Brady violations at the heart of them, it can be hard to differentiate between Brady issues and IAC issues. And that can often be a huge detriment to a defendant's case, because if the defendant raises it as a Brady claim and the court finds, nah, it wasn't the prosecutor's fault, it was the defense attorney's fault, well, they've lost their chance to proceed on those claims. And vice versa. If a defendant raises in his habeas an IAC claim, well, if the court finds that it wasn't the defense attorney's fault, it was the prosecutor's fault for not disclosing the evidence in the first place, well, again, their claim fails. So it often makes sense to bring both in a habeas petition. So what his attorneys did now, from King and Spalding and GIP, is they framed it in a way that gets at the true heart of the constitutional issues, that Dennis Perry was deprived of effective assistance of counsel because of what the prosecution did. Because of this evidence not being given to him and not being disclosed, his defense attorneys did not have the ability to give him a constitutionally sound defense.
Yeah, and this, for me, is really, really interesting. Looking at the brief, they cite a case of the Supreme Court of Georgia called Owens. And as many of you might know, I've been working on the case of George Alvarez, who was a ninth grade special education student in Texas who pleaded guilty to assault on a peace officer and was 4 years into his 8-year sentence when he learned there was a video, a surveillance video of this encounter that showed that, in fact, he was attacked and put in a chokehold and a headlock. And there's this whole question of, does the Brady Doctrine, the obligation of the prosecution to disclose material exculpatory evidence, does that apply only when the defendant has gone to trial, or does it also apply if the defendant pleaded guilty? Most courts have found if you plead guilty, you're out of luck. Brady Doctrine doesn't apply. And so what the Supreme Court of Georgia did in the Owens case that these attorneys are now citing to, the Owens case was a case where the defendant had pleaded guilty and the prosecution had withheld this material exculpatory evidence. And sort of to get around this rule that prevented George Alvarez from getting relief, what they say is, okay, well, even if Brady doesn't apply to guilty pleas, by withholding this evidence from trial counsel and defense counsel, they could not then advise their client to reject the guilty plea and go to trial. And that's why, even though it's not the fault of defense counsel, it's ineffective assistance of counsel. And so it's a really interesting ruling in Owens, and it remains good law in Georgia. And so I think this is a pretty strong argument made by King and Spalding to say, look, this precedent applies here. If it's not Brady, it certainly could be found to be ineffective assistance of counsel.
Talking to the void, it almost seems like, in a way, given how they're structuring these IAC arguments, anytime there's Brady, you can argue ineffective assistance, because basically that means a defense attorney just couldn't do his job.
IAC and Brady are often two sides of the same coin. And there's cases where it is clearly a Brady problem and cases where it is clearly an IAC problem. And then you have the vast void in between. And that's where a lot of egregious constitutional violations fall through the cracks of the courts. Because let's say there's a tiny bit of disclosure. Say the prosecutor slipped up and in a recorded interview accidentally referenced Dixie Foster. Well, that is not disclosure. There was never ever any answers given to the defense. But it's possible a court could look at this and say, you know what, the problem isn't the prosecutor because they slipped up and gave up that kernel of info. The problem was the defense attorney for not somehow being magically able to figure out who Dixie Foster was. And it's hard to predict which way the court's going to fall on that. So yeah, there needs to be a way to address these claims where there's obviously something has gone terribly wrong, where the alternate suspect who was called to trial to testify has in fact confessed to law enforcement, and that's never brought out of court. That is a constitutional violation, and many times prosecutors can avoid that by sort of trying to thread that needle and making it not quite Brady, not quite AAC.
And that's why it's interesting. I just wrote about this a few days ago. Virginia, we have the model rules of professional conduct that govern attorneys, and one of those rules is 3.8, which essentially governs Brady disclosures. And what they have proposed in Virginia is when there's exculpatory evidence, you can't do a document dump and sort of bury it in thousands of pages of discovery. You have to specifically identify as the prosecutor. Here is Brady material that's exculpatory. And so that sort of would fill that gap in one way, and this Owens case in Georgia fills it another way. But hopefully over the next few years, that gap will be filled one way or the other.
So in addition to Dennis Perry's Brady and ineffective assistance claims, the petition also included a third ground for relief. And this one's not premised on the state's constitutional misconduct or his lawyer's inability or failure to provide him with a competent defense.
And then we also have the last claim is a actual innocence claim and a miscarriage of justice claim, because, as you know, in the Constitution, it says that habeas corpus relief shall be granted to a petitioner to avoid a miscarriage of justice. And really, at the end of the day, that's what this is. This is a gross miscarriage of justice, not just for Dennis, but also for the women who were there that night, for Harold and Thelma Swain.
There's also a fourth claim in Dennis's habeas petition, but it's a bit different from the previous three claims that he raises. In this fourth claim, Dennis is asking the court for a more immediate sort of relief. He's asking for access to the complete transcripts of his trial. Because even though it's been 16 years since Dennis Perry was convicted, he still does not have a complete transcript of his trial, including, crucially, transcripts of the jury instructions and closing arguments. There's also portions from the first 3 days of his trial that we don't have either. And without the complete transcripts, we don't even know what it is exactly that we're missing.
Right. So our final claim in the petition is a claim that his due process rights have been violated because we have been unable to access his full and complete transcript, including closing arguments and jury instructions, as well as other instructions throughout the trial that may have been given to the jury to pay attention to or disregard evidence, or, you know, other interactions that may have occurred throughout the trial that may bear on ineffective assistance of counsel. It may bear on the way the state used this Brady material at trial. And we just can't fully articulate these claims, or we can't articulate them as well as we may be able to without the rest of the record that we do know exists. We just haven't been able to get it yet. So we do include a due process violation argument at the end of the brief.
Not having closing arguments for Dennis Perry's trial is a huge blow to his ability to effectively raise his habeas claims, because closing arguments are critical evidence for showing how the evidence was ultimately presented to the jury. Now, we're hopeful that one day complete transcripts will exist, because Dennis Perry's trial was recorded. So somewhere out there in Glynn County, a bunch of tape cassettes with his trial preserved on them in audio form should exist. That data has not been lost as far as we know.
But those tape cassettes are not something we have access to. This is the settled law in Georgia, thanks to the case of Undisclosed versus the state of Georgia. That was the suit we filed a couple years ago in connection with our season 2 case in Joy Watkins, in an attempt to obtain the audio recordings from his trial to use in the podcast. We lost. Supreme Court of Georgia ruled that court recordings are not court records, and therefore Undisclosed had no right to those recordings. Trial transcripts, yes. Those are court records that the court can't hide. But court recordings, those they don't have to give out to anyone. Now, this ruling, unfortunately, ended up having serious repercussions in our Season 3 case. Because in Dennis Perry's case, the trial transcripts for portions of that trial were never made in the first place. The only record of what was said is on those tape cassettes, and it's the court reporter's policy not to provide access to those tapes to anyone. What that means is, at this moment, there doesn't exist any record of Dennis Perry's trial that anyone has a right to obtain. Not Undisclosed, not even Dennis Perry himself. But such a record could be made to exist if a court reporter were to transcribe those tape cassettes. 10 months ago, the Georgia Innocence Project paid a $1,500 down deposit to the court reporter to request that those transcripts be created. But so far, just hasn't happened.
And we've been in close touch over the last year or so. I guess it's a little shy of a year, with the court reporter who has the rest of the tapes and who would be the one making the transcripts. And she very helpfully filed or signed an affidavit describing, you know, our efforts to get the transcript and her various constraints for why she's not able to provide it yet. And so she provided that for the court, and that was something that we were able to point to explain, you know, the work that we've been doing since this Brady's been uncovered to get those transcripts so that we can fully articulate these claims.
So what comes next in Dennis's case? Well, for now, we wait. And most likely, it'll be a while yet before Dennis has the opportunity to present these claims in a courtroom. Because most likely, the state will try and dismiss Dennis Perry's habeas petition the same way the state tried and succeeded to dismiss Joey Watkins' habeas petition. Most likely, the state will argue that it doesn't matter how much evidence of innocence the prosecution hid from Dennis Perry, or how insufficient Dennis Perry's defense was as a result. Most likely, the state will claim that it doesn't matter if Dennis Perry is innocent, because Dennis Perry voluntarily waived any right to ever complain about any of that by waiting 16 years to raise issues in court. Now, Dennis does have some claims available to him that were not available to Joey Watkins involving a change of law, particularly in regard to the issue of his waiver of his appellate rights, but not his habeas rights, based on new decisions from the Supreme Court of Georgia that came out last year. It is now crystal clear in Georgia that a defendant who waives his appeal rights has not waived his habeas rights. And based on that change in law, the clock should not have started ticking for Dennis Perry until that decision was reached, which was late fall of last year. But whatever comes next, it is virtually certain that there is a long, hard fight ahead for Dennis. But along with his attorneys at the Georgia Innocence Project and King & Spalding, he's ready for whatever comes next.
I will say I've spent some time with Dennis recently, quite a bit of time with Dennis recently, and his spirits are really high. He is very hopeful, and he is just incredibly grateful for all the work that's gone into his case, you know, last year and this year, and for the support that he's getting. You know, he feels the support that he's been getting from listeners and from, you know, just folks generally in the community, and he's really quite grateful for that.
I know as an attorney, it must be really hard to have a client that has their hopes up, because, I mean, everyone knows in this work, it's long odds always, every time.
It is. Yeah, it is. And we, you know, and we talk, we have candid conversations about that. But that's also the nature of this work, right? Mm-hmm. We work with folks at the Georgia Innocence Project all the time who have been subjected to a horrible injustice. Everyone copes with that in different ways, and no way is right or wrong. But Dennis is, you know, his ability to embrace hope right now is really important for him, and so we're hopeful with him, but we do recognize that these cases are hard, even in the face of incredibly compelling facts like we have here.
Thank you, Susan, for updating us both on Joey and Dennis. I get asked the question a lot. Actually, Susan and I were at CrimeCon last week, and we presented a whole panel about what's happening in Anand's case since the documentary. And I just want to update our listeners about what is happening next, because it's not that nothing's happening. We expect to be filing with the U.S. Supreme Court a petition for cert, hoping that they will take it sometime in the next couple of months. It is a long, long, long shot, but a lot of long shots have happened successfully in this case, so you never know. But we are also preparing for what's going to come after that, because we do anticipate that cert will not be granted and his case will not be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. So we're bringing new investigators on to the case. There are probably at least one, if not more, new attorneys coming onto the case, working along with the current legal team. And we are exploring other options to get back in state court and to get back in federal court. There's a lot more to be done. It is going to take years. And in the interim, we are still raising funds for his legal defense. So if you guys want to support him, launchgood.com/freeAdnan. I also have a Patreon page that I set up just for Adnan, where I kind of give updates every so often. Costs a few bucks a month if you want to join it. Just go to patreon.com/freeAdnan and you can join it. And all that money goes to his legal defense as well. So he's not in the best spirits, but he's doing better than he was a couple months ago. And he is thankful to everybody who continues to reach out and support him, send him letters and pictures and stuff like that. So thank you, guys. All right. Thanks so much, Susan and Colin. And we will be back on Monday with a new episode in our new season.
I'd like to thank the following people: Hannah McCarthy for audio production, Christy Williams and Nina Musser for website management, Baluki for our logo, Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for theme music, and Mital Telhan, our executive producer. I'd like to thank our sponsor for today, Omaha Steaks. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @UndisclosedPod.